Okay. Ready? Okay. Sometimes we do people, and it's hard to say what they accomplished in their lives. Whether they started the movement, whatever, but they had no jobs or anything. Rav Kook was everything to everybody, which is part of the problem. He's the first chief rabbi of Palestine. He founded Merkaz Harav. He was a philosopher. He was a poet. He was a Talmud Chacham. He was a posek. He was a Kabbalist. He was everything to everybody, and that was part of the problem, because he's really two completely different people. Rav Kook is as Haredi a person as you could ever meet, a person that just like suffused with love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and davening and all these things and no compromises. On the other hand, people thought he was a kofar. Okay, they were idiots, but they thought so. And the question is why? And the question is, you know, I think about Rav Kook in the same way. Do it this way. When I was in yeshiva, when Rav Lichtenstein said Harav, he meant Rav Soloveitchik. When Rav Amital said Harav, he meant Rav Kook. And everybody understood that those were the two Haravs that existed in the world. Much like Rav Soloveitchik, I think the fight over Rav Kook's legacy is enormous. Now, it's true that the Merkaz world sort of split between Har HaMor and whatever, so there's no, like, we are Rav Kook's descendants, even though I think there's a whole bunch of different people who would claim to be Rav Kook's descendants. But exactly who Rav Kook's descendants are, and what's clear about Rav Kook is that he's the father of religious Zionism, right? Anybody who's a religious Zionist would see in some form or another Rav Kook as being the person to whose movement he belongs. Okay? Let's tell a story that may help explain Rav Kook's magic. Anybody who know who the Nazir is?
Jesus.
Okay. There was a person in Merkaz who was Rav Kook's Talmud, who was a massive Talmud Chacham, Rav David Cohen, who was otherwise known as the Nazir. Okay? He accepted upon himself a vow of Nazirus at some point. But before that, the Nazir was kind of like a lost soul who was getting like doctorates in philosophy in Europe and like didn't really have a path. And he arranged for a meeting with Rav Kook in Switzerland at some point early on. Okay? And they met and they talked philosophy and it was okay. And they were going to meet again the next day. He was staying in some like boarding house, and his room was next to Rav Kook's. And the next morning, Rav Kook got up really, really early, and he listened to Rav Kook say the Parshas HaAkedah, and he said, in that moment, I knew that this is my Rebbe for the rest of my life. Like, in a way, that's Rav Kook. It just, the way he davened made the Nazir want to be his Talmud, and the Nazir followed him around the rest of his life. That's the story. Okay, let's talk about Rav Kook. He's born in a place called Gariva in Russia. It's now Latvia. Rav Shlomo Zalman Kook is his father. Rav Shlomo Zalman, he was the oldest of eight children. Rav Shlomo Zalman, his father, learned in Valazhin. He was like a Talmud of Valazhin. He associated with Valazhin. His mother came from Hasidic stock. His mother came from Chabad. She was a Chassid or a Talmud of the Tzemach Tzedek. Right, and Rav Kook sort of represented both of those things in his life. Litvish Valazhin and also Chassidus. From an early, Rav Kook was gifted, obviously. From an early age, he spoke only Hebrew to his father on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Like, that's fascinating. Some guy in Russia speaks only Hebrew on Shabbos and Yom Tov, because Shabbos and Yom Tov is different, because it's a holy day. Don't know why he did it, but he did it. Okay, at 18 years old, he goes to Valazhin, only for a year and a half, but in Valazhin, he gets very close to the Nitziv. He didn't like Reb Chaim. He didn't like that style of learning, but he loved the Nitziv. He also became very close to somebody else. His name is Rav Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Ta'omim. It stands for the Aderet, who's famous because he later on became the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. But first, he and Rav Kook became close, which is almost certainly how Rav Kook came to marry his daughter. Okay, that's how it worked.
That does make sense.
He went on many, many dates with the father-in-law. When it worked out, he married his daughter. Okay? Thank you. Okay. So he marries that daughter, which somehow makes him like a form of royalty, because the Adaret is famous, and he's the Adaret's son-in-law now. Sadly, well, before that, okay, at 23, he takes his first rabbinic position in a little town called Zalmel. Sadly, his wife dies, like very young. I don't know anything about why she died or what it was, but she died. Interestingly, the Adaret, who he loved, convinces him to marry his niece.
What?
I'll explain. There's nothing wrong with it. The Adaret had a twin brother whose name was Tzvi Yehuda. Okay? And he had a daughter. The twin brother had a daughter. And so Rav Kook married her. Rav Kook then had a son who he named Tzvi Yehuda. Okay. He also had three daughters, again, one of whom died at the age of 12 in some like tragic circumstance, which we're not going to discuss. Okay. Now he's living in Russia. And life is pretty miserable in Russia as they're having these things called pogroms. So whether it's we're Zionists or it's we got to get out of Russia, Zionism becomes a thing, right? People talk about living in Israel. There's an official movement called Chibat Zion, to which a lot of Jews join. Rav Kook had an uncle who was a serious Talmud Chacham who made Aliyah in the 1880s. With thousands of other Jews. What kind of influence on Rav Kook had, it's hard to know, except it's clear that he corresponded with his uncle, but also just the fact that you know somebody who's living in Israel, like, changes their perspective. It's not just people move to Israel, but his uncle moved to Israel, and his uncle was fine, and this deeply affected Rav Kook. The Chibat Zion movement permeated Valazhin. There was called not Chibat Zion, it was called Nes Tziona. Okay? In Valazhin, Reb Chaim Valazhin was part of it. The Netziv was part of it, but it had to be kept a secret because it was illegal in Russia to like make a plan to leave. Okay? So that's that. Hard to know. Yes?
Did you say Reb Chaim was against Zionism?
Correct. Now, we have to make a distinction. It'll come up later when we can talk about it now. You can be an anti-Zionist, but love the land of Israel. We want to live in the land of Israel, right? There's a difference between the political movement Zionism and, like, you know, there are Haredim who lived in Israel. They're not Zionists. They just lived in Israel. Okay? Now, what?
They currently live in Israel.
Okay, good. At some point while living in Russia, Rav Kook writes a manifesto that basically gets adopted by Zionists. It's called, in English, The Mission of Israel and Its Nationhood. That's a real title. And what I mean is, he argued that Jewish nationalism would bring Mashiach, not replace it. Now here you come to like the fight that existed then and exists today. The Haredi view was, we can't let these Mechalei Shabbos found the state of Israel. Why not? Because if they're successful in founding the state of Israel, Israel and nationalism and Zionism will replace Judaism. And Rav Kook thought the opposite, like exactly the opposite. Rav Kook thought, if you get people excited about the land of Israel, if you get people excited about being Jews, if you get people excited about a nationalistic movement, it will lead them to become frum. Rav Kook could not imagine a world, which frankly we have today, in which the overwhelming majority of Israelis are not frum. He thought the state would naturally lead to more observance, not less observance. On this issue, Haredim were right. Right? It has not led to more Shmiras HaMitzvahs, to more Shmiras HaShabbos, to more things like that we have a state of Israel. Rav Kook thought it would naturally do so, that anybody who was into the state of Israel, anybody who lived in the state of Israel, would become more religious, would get swept up in a movement that's led not by a person, and not by necessarily Theodor Herzl or any other Mechalei Shabbos, that's led by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, again, Rav Kook was factually wrong on this. It doesn't make him less valuable or anything like that, but I just think you have to admit that on this point, he was wrong. Okay, at 39, Rav Kook makes Aliyah to become the chief rabbi of Yafo. Yafo was a really important city back then. It's a big job. It's Yafo and the surrounding areas. And he starts at this point, again, Rav Kook really, really believed in Kiruv. not like Kiev will get this Jew, will get that. He thought, you know, if we make a state, if we do all these things we're supposed to do, these people will naturally become more religious. So Rav Kook basically starts traveling around the land to interact with Chilonim. He goes, he spends Shabbosim, even though there's no kosher food. It's really like an amazing thing. He takes some Haredi people with him. He really builds on his relationship with Chilonim. He tries to teach them how to grow Esrogim. Okay, he started his yeshiva then also. And he starts expanding his ideas. And again, the idea that Jewish nationhood, the idea that strong Jews, like later on he had a crisis because people thought he said good things when they, at the founding of Bar Ilan, it's Hebrew U. He spoke at the dedication of Hebrew U. And again, as normal, he was accused by the Haredim of saying kfira things and not being from, like crazy, crazy challenges to him. But it's true. He spoke about Jews being strong. He spoke about strong Jews defending the state of Israel, which is something that people were afraid to do, and maybe he shouldn't have done. Okay. His first Shemitah in Israel is an enormous fight about the Heter Mechira. It's not the first time it had come up. It was instituted first in 1888. It didn't have that much support. Okay. In 1909, Rav Kook supports it. Everybody else is against it. Rav Kook thought it was similar to Hillel with respect to Prosbul, which is, it's only Drabanan anyway. Okay, almost certainly the Heter Mechira would not be a thing if Shemitah was Doraisa. But since it's only Drabanan, Rav Kook thought it could work. He thought people desperately needed it. The Haredim hated him for it. Now, again, the relationship between Rav Kook and the Haredim is complicated because, you know, idiot Haredim, like kids and yeshiva kids who didn't recognize who Rav Kook was, they were really cruel to him. You know, they put up Pashkevilim against him. They accused him of all these things. The Talmidei Chachamim who were Haredim were conflicted because they recognized that Rav Kook was a colleague of theirs. He was as big a Talmud Chacham, if not bigger, than anybody who lived at the time. He was really frum. He really cared. It was harder for them. Like if you find letters, Haredi Gedolim wrote to Rav Kook with great respect. Other Haredim, you know, didn't write. They never wrote to Rav Kook at all. But they didn't treat him with respect because they're just not smart enough to see who he was. Okay. The Agudas Yisrael started in 1912. Rav Kook, it's funny how wrong he was. He hoped it would be Zionist. Obviously it wasn't. So at that time, Mizrahi also started. And Mizrahi and Aguda represented two different extremes, I suppose, of orthodoxy. Rav Kook, for his entire life, never joined either. Anybody who tells you Rav Kook was part of the Aguda, it's not true. Anybody who tells you Rav Kook was part of Mizrahi is also not true.
What is Mizrahi?
I remember. Us. Oh. Okay, it's a place you go to meet girls. It's the Zionist, supposedly from part of the world.
Got it.
Okay? Okay, in 1913, Rav Kook was invited to address the Mizrahi Convention. He said yes, in the end he couldn't go, so he sent a long letter. In 1914, he was invited to attend the Aguda Convention in Germany, and he went for what was supposed to be a short trip. But that's when World War I broke out. And he was arrested because, I don't know, he was arrested. There are different stories about how he got out. He definitely didn't run away. But Rav Kook, for a lot of the war, lived with the Kimchis. If you don't know the Kimchis, so Rav Kimchi used to be the Rashiva of a high school in Efrat, who tells stories in his childhood about Rav Kook. You know, he lived in their house in Switzerland and in England. Then he became the Rav of Machzike Hadas in London. By the way, I don't know if he learned English. They must have all just spoke Yiddish at the time. It's hard for me to know.
What about Hebrew?
Huh?
What about Hebrew?
They didn't speak Hebrew. The regular Brit in 1918 didn't speak Hebrew. Okay? Fine. While he's there, a very significant event happens. Anyone want to guess?
The Holocaust?
In 1917, the Balfour Declaration. Okay, and this is like a great example of what life was like. Rav Kook celebrated the Balfour Declaration without hesitation. He met with Chaim Weizmann. It was the greatest thing that ever happened. Okay? He told Brits at the time it was their great honor to return the land to its rightful owners. Okay? That's how strongly he felt. Aguda, of course, protested. They said the Brits had no right to give the chosen land to a bunch of Mechallelei Shabbos. Right? That was how bad it was. So they opposed Rav Kook, they opposed the Balfour Declaration. They basically said, you know, only Mashiach can give the land back to the Jews. This was and continues to be like the real defining issue, which is if you're a Haredi, you really, how do you know that God wants us to be here? So I suppose, it sounds crazy, but I suppose you sit out everything. If some great miracle happens and God appears to you in your bed at night and gives you the land of Israel and tells you this is great, then you know. But if anybody else, if any man in the world helps you to conquer the land, well, how do you know that that's God? Right? Rav Kook thought the obvious. Of course God wants people to take back the land of Israel. Of course he wants people, and by people he means from people and not from people. It doesn't matter. He wants Jews. Rav Kook saw a major distinction between Gentiles and Jews. He really thought that Gentiles shared more with animals than they shared with Jews. That we're a chosen people, and genetically and otherwise, we're different than other people. It wasn't that he didn't like Gentiles. He liked Gentiles. He just thought they were different. But he didn't see that difference between Chilonim and what we would call Datiim. Okay? Okay, Rav Kook thought that Mizrahi was not from enough. Mizrahi had like a statement which they said, Zionism had nothing to do with religion. Now for Rav Kook, Zionism had everything to do with religion. There is no Zionism without religion. Zionism is a religious concept. But for the Mizrahi, for politics, for whatever purpose, you know, they disagreed with that, and therefore he basically criticized that organization. But of course, Aguda themselves was stuck in some rigid, limited past in which they claimed that, you know, if God didn't do it himself, it doesn't count. And God doesn't do things himself anymore. They can wait for the rest of humanity. God's not going to do it himself. Okay, that's just a silly position to defend, but they did. Now, what's left for Rav Kook? Mizrahi's not from enough. Aguda's too from. Not too from, but Aguda's, you know, they're limited and narrow. So he makes a new organization called Degel Yerushalayim, but the thing is, it fails immediately because there's just not enough room between Mizrahi. You know, anybody who tries to build something right in the middle between Mizrahi and Aguda, there wasn't enough space, there wasn't enough room, and it failed. But that's what Rav Kook was looking for. He was looking for something frumer than Mizrahi and less Haredi than Aguda. Yes? I assume. Don't ask. Okay. We'll do it later. It doesn't. I'm not misleading you in terms of their position. Yes, you could ask a million questions. Let's go. Now, here's a strange story. Degel Yerushalayim. Okay. After the war ends, thank God Rav Kook can finally get back to Israel. Okay. Now, how does he become the chief rabbi of Palestine? This is kind of interesting. The British, in an effort to sort of, you know, give the Jews something. They thought that they gave the Jews more autonomy in the land of Israel, you know, there would be fewer fights. So the British had an idea to make a chief rabbinate. It's interesting. It wasn't anybody else. It was the British. And in 1921, they make Rav Kook the chief rabbi. He's the Ashkenazi chief rabbi. For some reason, the Sephardi chief rabbi, somebody named Rav Meir or something. I don't know. He didn't really make a name for himself. But that's where Rav Kook really has a falling out with Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was the head of the old Yishuv. Means he was like the Haredi chief rabbi. Okay? And he thought that the chief rabbinate was a big mistake. And he thought that Rav Kook shouldn't have done it. And he basically cut himself off from Rav Kook. From then on, he referred to him as the rabbi from Yafo. He never said his name, even though they had been very close before. Again, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was a real kanai. Anything modern, anything secular, any secular knowledge, he was against all of it. Rav Kook was not. Rav Kook said, Hayashan Yitchadesh, Vahachadash Yitkadesh. He was looking for progress. He believed in new things. He believed in sanctifying new things. He really believed that he lived in the time of Mashiach. Right? It's not like a theoretical idea. Rav Kook believed it deeply. And more than that, he believed that Chilonim would do God's work, that they were doing God's work, and that eventually would start keeping the Torah, because how could you do God's work and not keep the Torah? It would have to happen. Okay? Rav Kook quoted the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Tzad Yiches Amun Aleph, which said, Vam Rav Yochanan, Ein Ben David Ba, Ela Bedor Shekulo Zakai, O Kulo Chayav. He thought his generation was both. Right? There were people who were Kulo Chayav, and there were people who were Kulo Zakai. And therefore Mashiach had to come. Now, let's stop for a second. Rav Kook was not living in the time of Mashiach. Okay? He was wrong about that. What happens after Rav Kook passes away? Huh? The Holocaust. Meaning, you know, when you read Rav Kook and you listen to the Talmid of Rav Kook talk about, it sounds like Rav Kook lived in the 1940s. And he was living in Yemos HaMashiach, and the state's going to be... But he lived before the greatest tragedy, you know, in Jewish history, right, which is the Holocaust. I don't know that anybody's really worked this out in the philosophy of Rav Kook, how it could be that he thought all these things, then the Holocaust came. He did, you know, he foresaw that the state of Israel was coming. But again, it would be dishonest to not recognize the fact that he lived before World War II, he lived before the Holocaust, and all the things he said have to be seen in light of the fact that, you know, a third of the Jewish people were wiped out in a big event that he didn't anticipate. Okay, that's a fact we have to deal with. Now, why did Rav Kook believe that all Chilonim would do tshuva? Because he thought atheism is like a passing fad. That's really the truth. He thought it's an aberration. It'll have to fall away. If we build a state, you know, inherent in the state will be the existence of God. Again, it hasn't played out that way. But that's what Rav Kook thought. He thought, you know, when you're deeply religious, when you feel these things, he thought that God is in all of our hearts, you know, and the land of Israel will help these things come out. And like Chilonim will wake up and just say, there's something wrong with our lives because God is not part of our lives. Rav Kook believed that deeply. He thought we needed more ideology to reveal the beauty of religion and less dry halacha. It's hard to know exactly how that fits in generally with his philosophy. But, you know, he was into outreach. He was into making Judaism beautiful, and he did do that. He thought there could be a Jewish literature. He thought there could be Jewish art. He thought there could be Jewish music. He thought culture could play a role in this. You understand why Charedim were terrified of all this. But he thought so. He also was pretty much in favor of secular studies. Again, nobody learned more than Rav Kook. None of this is to water down, God forbid, like real Talmud Torah. But he thought there was place for all of this. Okay, so then who's Rav Kook? Rav Kook is a dialectic, I suppose. On the one hand, he's the frumest, holiest person. By the way, he dressed like a Haredi. Right? It wasn't like he wore a shirt like me. I mean, he wore a shirt like I'm wearing today. No, he didn't. There's no pictures of Rav Kook with like his bekesha off. So I couldn't tell you what color shirt he wore, but I'm pretty sure it was white. Okay? So again, he's like a Haredi who saw the need for innovation, for secular studies, for political renewal. You know, if you ask the question, was he right or not, it's hard to know. The Holocaust makes you think that he wasn't, but the stuff that's happening now makes you think that he was. He's clearly the driving force for the world we live in, for Dati Lumi. Again, it's not how it used to be in this yeshiva when, again, if anybody other than Rav Lichtenstein said Harav, they meant Rav Kook. I think that's probably the fault of his successors. You know, Har Hamor split off from Merkaz, and there's now different groups who all claim to be authentic Talmidim of Rav Kook.
Like Gush.
No, it's exactly not like Gush.
But we claim to be the real Talmidim of Chris. No.
Okay, let's just ignore him. Okay, I'll finish with a story. When Rav Soloveitchik came to Israel to run for chief rabbi, I think of Tel Aviv, early, so he spent Shabbos in a kibbutz. And he brought his own food, because he clearly wasn't going to eat. And the people in the kibbutz said to him, no, we have a kosher kitchen, and we're careful. And he said, but you work on Shabbos. And they said, many years ago, Rav Kook came to our kibbutz for Shabbos. And Rav Kook brought his own food. And so Friday night, he sat in the, in the Chadar Ochel, and he sang Zmiros himself, and everybody ignored him. And Shabbos morning, everybody went to work in the fields, and Rav Kook had his own lunch, and he sat there, and he sang. And Rav Kook never said a word to them, and they never said a word to him. And after Shabbos, he said goodbye, and he was warm, and for whatever reason, they decided they're going to have a kosher kitchen because of Rav Kook. Because Rav Kook came, and he showed them love. Rav Kook was in favor of getting people to keep Shabbos, but not in a negative way. Rav Kook loved Chilonim. He went out of his way to spend time with them, to be a role model for them. But he never made his peace with Chilul Shabbos, God forbid. And these people decided to start keeping kosher and start keeping Shabbos because of the role model that Rav Kook was. He came, he didn't let them upset him. I think at the start of Shabbos, they must have hated him. He's a chief rabbi, he's a firm person. Chilonim in those days, it wasn't just that they weren't observant. Like, they were non-observant. They made a decision to be non-observant. They didn't like religion. Again, Rav Kook thought he could fix all those things. But Rav Kook fixed it in a way that, there was a bakery in his neighborhood that opened on Shabbos, and he was furious about it. So after davening, he and his entire kehilla went to the bakery. And all he did was shake hands with the owner and say, Shabbat Shalom. And the next guy said Shabbat Shalom. The next guy said Shabbat Shalom. Eventually, the guy closed the store on Shabbos. Not because Rav Kook explained to him that it's usur. Because Rav Kook explained to him that he loved him. And that if he loved him, he should be a real Jew. And real Jews don't have their bakeries open on Shabbos. He had the power to do that in a way that, if we did, it would be better. If Haredim did, Mashiach would come. But it's really something to have your love of God be the thing that makes the other guy wrong. It's not because they made a mistake. It's because if you love God, you wouldn't do this. All right? Let's stop here this afternoon. Halacha track, all the other things. Have a great, great day.